Hi, I'm Mel Majoros. I am a five-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. Today we are talking to author, and he's also a father. It's Dr. William Penzer. He wrote a book, How to Cope Better When You Have Cancer, as well as, I guess it would be called a compendium to that, How to Cope Better When Someone You Love Has Cancer. How are you today, doctor?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I hope you're well as well.
Yes. Now, should I call you doctor? I mean, I know
I'd rather you call me Bill.
Excellent.
Some people have a difficulty with that. I hope you won't. I'm a regular guy. I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a psychologist, and I've been helping people in the Fort Lauderdale area for the better part of 40 years. So I'm perfectly comfortable with everyone calling me Bill.
Well, thank you, Bill. So let's jump right into it. You found out when your daughter was 31 in 2005 that she had cancer. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, that is exactly the case. She had a little pimple-like bump on one of her breasts. Of course, we reassured her and told her 99% of the time, it's not anything, don't worry, it'll be okay.
Of course.
And lo and behold, we got the 0.01% of the time when she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Let me quickly say that my daughter joined our family when she was 2 years, 4 months, as we adopted her from Korea.
Ah.
So anyone who believes in the myth that Asian people are not prone to breast cancer, we'll clarify right now that that's not true. And even the doctors we dealt with said that's more myth than reality, and the statistics are pretty comparable. But anyway, she was diagnosed, and on July 8th, 2005, she underwent a mastectomy at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York, and followed that up with a pretty intense dose of chemotherapy. The good news is she's doing fine today, knock wood, and post-chemo, she was told that the likelihood of her ever being able to conceive a child was pretty low, and she had no children as of yet, and happy to report that in November, she gave birth to a beautiful little girl. So so much for medical predictions. They are not always true. And one of the things both of my books do is encourage people to take all those numbers either lightly or disregard them, because for all the predictions that are made, no one knows the future. No one has a crystal ball. My mentor, Bernie Siegel, MD, the author of Love, Medicine, and Miracles, among 10 or 12 other books, would say that to you. He is a physician. He, for many years, was a surgeon, and he would be the first to say that no one can predict the future accurately. Unfortunately for us, in this case, we have a new baby granddaughter, despite those dire predictions.
Well, and going back to
that fateful day, July 8th, 2005,
yes.
Here I was, was back then, a pretty good psychologist. I'm very good at helping people navigate the choppy waters of life,
yes,
whatever those choppy waters might contain. But to be frank and honest, as I am throughout the book, I found myself drowning in those choppy waters in a kind of a not my kid feeling, because I think we all live in a bit of denial where we believe that our children, grandchildren, and loved ones have a protective shield around them. We believe we can protect them, which is frankly another illusion. And so I was not doing well. And as I sat there in the waiting rooms and looked around at all the gray, bleak, sad faces, right then and there on that day, I said, if this will turn out okay, someday I'm going to write a book for people in my position, for the caregivers, although I do not like the word caregivers, and I am trying to start a movement for that to be changed to so that friends and family will be called heart and soul givers.
Oh, I like
caregivers
that.
To me. Caregiver is a little cold, a little sterile. And I associate it to the medical team. They're providing that kind of care. But you know firsthand the people around you when you're dealing with cancer, they truly are heart and soul givers in every sense of the term. So that was my goal, to write a book for the heart and soul givers and guide them through this difficult journey. When I started with our daughter, Jody, I felt that it was not only cancer was not only a dreaded diagnosis, mm-hmm. it was actually a place. It felt like I had entered a place, a very foreign kind of land with its own culture, rituals, customs, language, and overwhelming, confusing confusions. And I eventually came to call that Cancerville.
I
believe that many who have been there will agree that it is feels like you've entered a very strange and alien place. And my goal was to write a guidebook for people to cope better in that very demanding and an overwhelming place.
As a psychologist, who did you turn to when you found out your daughter had cancer? I mean, most people may turn to their psychologist or their doctor. Who does the psychologist / heart and soul giver turn to?
Good question. First, I looked for a book, and I didn't find a book directed at the heart and soul giver. Numerous books, obviously, for the patient,
right.
But I could not find any books, which is another reason I wrote How to Cope Better When Someone You Love Has Cancer. I eventually put myself into counseling, just because one is a mental health professional, let's say. I learned in the 70s, which is a whole other story that I won't get into, but I learned in the 70s that my degree did not come with a vaccine. And I went through a fairly long period of what was available at the time, psychoanalysis, mm-hmm. Which is a long way to get where you need to get, but a very interesting experience. And so when I found myself struggling, probably by 2006, I just found myself a counselor and said, I'll try not to be difficult, because mental health professionals can be the most difficult of patients, just like doctors can be the most difficult of medical patients. And I had her support and her help, of course. My wife and I tried to work our best together, although she was struggling herself to deal with our daughter having to go through this nightmare. But basically, I eventually, in addition to the counseling, drew from all the tools that I know that I would be helping others with. But it took me a while to get past the shock and the awful and the feeling of helplessness. One of the strong points of the book is that although the family and friends feel helpless, there's a lot that they can do to make a difference. And sometimes it's a small little thing. Mm-hmm. And with our daughter years later, I found out that a little stuff, I want to call it a doll, but a thingamajig, a pink something or other, that I gave her the day of her surgery, became her comfort, became her support. And being a psychologist, I believe it also became a symbolic representation of me or of us when we couldn't be there because my daughter was living in New York and we are living in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, which becomes a whole nother issue of,
right.
Going back and forth and dealing with all of that. Actually, communication since 2005 have magically improved to the point
yes.
where, everybody has a phone, just about everybody has a phone, and it texts and it emails and it sends pictures, and it makes life in many ways a lot easier to deal with.
Now, I was adopted too, Bill, and so the information that I got from my birth parents did not have cancer there. But then when I got more information, it did. did you know that Jody's background had any cancer in it, or did it not?
We know nothing of her background, which is why she ultimately had the BRCA test. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
To see if there was any heritability, which there was not.
Oh, that's good.
But we have no information with regard to her birth parents of any kind, which in these kinds of situations makes it a little more complicated. But fortunately, the medical test exists, and she was able to get that feedback.
So she must have been shocked, because I know that as a cancer advocate, we're trying to enlighten the medical community on at least mentioning possibly cancer, so it's not like a shock, or the doctors say, well, I had no idea, and they told me that I was, the guy said, well, I've done these for 25 years, and I've only had a handful of diagnoses that surprised me, and you're one of them. And it's like, well, that's not what I wanted to hear. I would have rather said, you know what, there's a slim chance it could be cancer, but, you know, I mean, I'd rather know everything than, I mean, you're never going to not be surprised when someone tells you you have cancer. But at least I think I would have been a little more mentally prepared than not.
Mm-hmm. I agree. One of the people I reference in the book, Susan, who I was helping at the time, said to me that when she received the diagnosis, it was like being hit in the face with a mortality pie, because all of a sudden your consciousness is raised, your denial of death disappears instantly, and now you're wondering if you're going to make it through. And that's why I tried to write my book based on a philosophy I call realistic optimism, because I believe very strongly that that having optimism, riding through Cancerville on a horse I call hope, it may not change the outcome. There have been documented studies where it can, but it may not change the outcome, but it makes the journey a little bit lighter, a little bit easier, because those three words, you have cancer, do smack you upside the head. There is no doubt about it. The other side of the coin, however, is that in my day, it was the big C. No
yes.
one talked about it, or if they did, it was in hushed tone. And at least now it is out there in the universe, unfortunately, much more spoken much more often than any of us would like.
Exactly.
But I think, as with so many other areas of life, it's become desensitized, and there's probably not a person that isn't dealing with or knowing of somebody in their immediate world who is dealing with cancer. So it's probably not as shocking today as it would have been in the 50s, let's say, when there was so little awareness, consciousness, or information.
I was shocked when I get hit with the it's cancer pie. I'll tell you that right
mm-hmm.
now.
You didn't have any warning or any symptoms or anything like that?
I found a lump. They did a biopsy. And like I said, when I knew it was bad was when my doctor says, we have your test results. How soon can you get here? So, you know, they never invite you over if they have extra brownies from the bake sale. So it's always bad news. So, I mean, my whole ride over there, I knew it was that, because, I mean, what else could it be? So,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, it's good that it's not the kind of thing you want to hear over the phone either. So.
I just read an editorial written by a doctor where a woman was told she had breast cancer over the phone, and when she asked how quickly she could come in, her appointment was made for 5 days later. So she had 5 days to sit and wonder and worry. And I even made contact with a woman who, it turned out, got her cancer diagnosis in the form of a form letter through the mail.
What?
Yes, she did. I have a copy of the letter.
Oh, my gosh.
So
Those doctors would be fired. I would just be like, thank you for the information, and you're done. I'm finding someone else who's a little more compassionate.
As you know, not all doctors are created equal, and some with very excellent intelligence and technical skills lack the bedside manner that everyone dealing with a serious illness really, really needs. So
yes.
I think people have to be selective if they have choices in choosing doctors with whom they are compatible, with whom they can communicate comfortably,
exactly.
and who will show a certain degree of compassion and support, which is what my books actually try to provide as well, a great
Excellent.
Deal of compassion and support and guidance. I wanted to make a comment about, I often say that my daughter's experience in Cancerville planted a fuse inside my brain that someday I would write a book. But what really lit that fuse was a unique interaction that I had in June of 2010, almost 5 years from the day I went through the awful scene in Memorial Sloan Kettering.
Yes.
And it was an email from my longest friend, over 50 years. We met back in college days. And it simply said, my grandson has been diagnosed with the worst form of leukemia. Funny enough, okay. that's still, not funny enough, sad enough, that still chokes me up when I say it.
Mm-hmm.
The boy is fine, I will tell you that right up front. And I didn't know what to do or how to reach out beyond the basics. And the next day, I sent an email to the boy's father, Rob, my friend's son. And I knew my friend's son in a casual kind of way. I knew his occupation. I knew he had written a few novels in his spare time. But I didn't really know Rob, the father of Jake and Chase, their fraternal twins, 8 years old at the time. And I sent him an email, not as a psychologist trying to be a shrink, but as one father who had been to Cancerville to another father who had just entered. And he sent me back an immediate email, and he said, I've gotten over 200 emails since my son was diagnosed 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
I've deleted all of them. Yours I've saved, made a copy of, and read it at least 5 times a day.
Oh,
and
wow.
I don't even remember what I said, but I imagine it gave him some comfort, some support, some optimism, and hope. And that began an interaction over a period of about a year where I would read in his blog that he kept something or other, and I would send him an email. Probably over the course of the year, more than 100 emails were sent by me.
Mm-hmm.
And what I came to realize is here, my words through it, my written words through the email could help a veritable stranger. So that plus the miraculous story about Jake's survival really lit the fuse that got me to start writing the book, which symbolically enough, I began to write the introduction on July 8th, 2010.
Oh, wow.
5 years to the 5 years to the hour from her mastectomy.
Did you realize it was that close to the time, or did you just start writing and then went, wow?
I would say I realized that I didn't wait for it to happen.
Right.
It just grabbed me in the moment, and I said, okay, now is the time to start. Get your yellow pad going. and I did. The inspiring story about Jake is he was not given a very solid chance for survival, and yet the doctors had to hit him hard with chemo, I believe 5 separate chemos over, you know, quite a few week period. Finally got him close enough into remission where they were able to bring in Chase, his fraternal twin brother, who was a perfect bone marrow match.
Oh, that's excellent.
And that bone marrow actually saved Jake's life. And he's doing really fine in all respects. In fact, on the 26th next week, he skates out with his heroes, the New York Rangers,
nice.
Onto center ice, I guess, because they've sort of reached out to him to give him the kind of support he needed when he was in the hospital for months at a time, and now as a survivor. So it's a very powerful story, and it plays a role in both books. I should mention quickly that it was never my intention to write a book for the patient, because A, there are many of them out there, and B, I was never a patient. I've been to Cancerville by proxy through my daughter. But what happened was that cancer patients began reading the book for the heart and soul giver, and communicated to me that even though they weren't the intended audience, it really, really helped them. And so they encouraged me to write a book for the patient, which I did, How to Cope Better When You Have Cancer. And in the process, Bernie Siegel, MD, who I mentioned before,
yes,
took me under his wing, never knew him before, but he liked the book for the heart and soul giver. And he taught me as much as I could learn about blessings and miracles and spirituality and healing, and then was generous enough to write the foreword for the book for the patient as
That's
well.
Awesome.
So that was a very special growth for me. Whoever says you can't teach an old dog new tricks is not exactly always correct either, but I did learn a few important things from that.
Well, and I think that when you have a book about your heart and soul givers, the patient doesn't really realize when, you know, I didn't realize how much my fiance was going through when I was going through it until, you know, after. Because, of course, they always have to be strong for you. But, you know, obviously we have a good support system, but sometimes they probably feel, well, who's going to be strong for me?
Right. And the heart and soul givers typically have been a neglected group.
Mm-hmm.
As measured
yes.
by the fact that there weren't any books for me back in 2005, and there still aren't too many. And it's also measured by the fact that at any workshop that I've spoken at around the country, the majority of the presentations are directed at the patient, and the heart and soul givers get really short shrift. In fact, they were very happy at the Weekend of Hope in Stowe, Vermont last May that my presentation was totally focused on the heart and soul givers. I don't know if your listeners are aware of the Weekend of Hope in Stowe, Vermont. It's a wonderful, wonderful program where every year for the past 11, they invite 300 or more cancer patients and heart and soul givers, put them up in hotels without charge, and put on this amazing and inspiring Weekend of Hope workshop where I had the privilege of speaking. And they just do a marvelous job of creating a community of survivors.
Wow.
You know, hopeful, hopeful people.
I'll have to check that out for sure, because I haven't heard about that.
Mm-hmm.
And more and more survivors need to know about it for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. The positive part of all of this
yes.
book writing, it's certainly not a profitable endeavor.
That's what I hear.
From a point of view, in fact, my wife not too long ago said, "Please don't write another book." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "We can't afford it." And I laughed and said, "Well, you kind of right about that, but I do have another book in the oven.
Oh.
It's actually a workbook. It's called the I'm Not Only a Cancer Patient, I'm a Survivor workbook. And it's a very practical, activity-based opportunity for the cancer patient at this point, the adult cancer patient, to strengthen their coping skills in a variety of different ways. And I hope to have that out in a couple of months. But what I was saying is, even though it's not profitable financially, I told my family when I first started to write this, I said, if I can help even one person, if I can make a difference in one person's life who was walking in the same footprints I left behind
yes.
in Cancerville, it would be gratifying to me. And obviously, there are a lot more than one person that has given me feedback about the books. But just the other day, I received an email from a total stranger. Her name is Barbara. And among other things of complimentary nature, she said, your book was my saving grace. My husband
That's
has been
awesome.
Battling leukemia for more than a year, and your book helped me so much to deal with it and to help him as well. And that kind of feedback, it fills what I call my pride bank, which at the end of the day is far more important than our piggy banks.
Exactly.
So, I'm very grateful and humbled to have had the opportunity for my words to reach out and help Rob, Jake and Chase's dad, and to all kinds of people who are finding the book at Amazon and Kindle or ordering it through the cancerable.com website. And let me mention about the website.
Yes, tell me about the website.
In addition to being able to read pieces of the book, I think the introductions are on there, the prefaces. In addition to that, there's an amazing, amazing video produced by my son-in-law, who is a professional photographer and owns a videography company in New York. We, in 2008, we bought a trip for four people through a breast cancer fundraising auction to go to South Africa and Tanzania and Kenya. So the video is a beautiful travelogue, if you will, about 15 minutes long. But the piece of resistance, as it were, is that, as it turned out, unplanned when we left on the trip, our daughter and her fiancé were married in a Maasai village there with the entire tribe participating and the chief officiating and everything being translated back into English from their native language. So it's a very powerful, enjoyable, and inspiring video that shows that we can go from the outhouse of Cancerville to the penthouse of life. And in fact, the birth of her little daughter back in November took us to the pinnacle of life, if you will. So if you connect all the dots from a child who was orphaned in Korea to a young woman who enjoyed a wonderful life until the breast cancer diagnosis, then has, you know, becomes a survivor, ends up getting married through a breast cancer fundraiser in a Maasai village, and then ends up having a beautiful little girl. If that doesn't inspire people, I don't know what will. If that doesn't place people on the horse I call hope, I don't frankly know what will, because it's a very good story. Just like, and although I don't know the details, your story is.
Well, here
you were shocked, hit in the face with a cancer diagnosis, and here you are doing a mitzvah, if you will, by sponsoring a program, having a blog, and giving hope and information and support to countless numbers of people in Cancerville. Well, what a wonderful way to turn your unfortunate experience
Yes.
into a blessing. And I meet so many people who are doing something or other to
Right.
contribute back to Cancerville. I myself just thought about it. I'm sponsoring a Relay for Life team that
Nice.
We will meet in April in Plantation, Florida. And our goal is to raise $10,000 for the American Cancer Society.
I love the Relay for Life.
All we can do when we get hit in the face is learn how to cope with it, learn how to adapt to this very strange, foreign, and alien place, and then assume we will be a survivor, too, and we'll give back in some meaningful fashion.
And hopefully at some point they'll have to close Cancerville because there'll have been a cure. I mean, that would be perfect.
I speak about that in the book. That is my dream and
Yes.
my fantasy, that someday Cancerville becomes a ghost town and all the medical facilities become focused on other serious medical problems and we leave it behind. And there are countless numbers of people all over the world and billions of dollars all being directed toward that goal. And we can only hope and pray that sooner than later we will be able to celebrate that.
Well, thank you, Bill, for joining us today on the show. Cancerville.com is the website, and you can order the book from there, as well as probably
Well, for either from there or from Amazon or from Kindle. And also, if the listeners want to go to CancerVille.com Facebook page and like it, they'll be able to read my periodic blogs as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Bill, so much for joining me today on this. I'm sure it's nice in Florida. It's a little chilly here in Michigan, but you can send some of that sunshine my way if you would.
I will do my best, and I won't give you a graphic description to aggravate you, but it is one lovely day here. And it's been my pleasure and my honor to speak with you, and I wish you well.
Well, thank you.
All of the listeners well in their pursuit of survivalship.
Well, thank you so much for that. I'm going to wrap up like I usually do. This is Mal Majerus. I am the Cancer Warrior. You can always find me on Facebook because I am a Facebook junkie, Mal Majerus. Become a fan of the Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com on Facebook. Check out my blog, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com. And as always, life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's the Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.